Hello and welcome to The Culture Bunker, your weekly pop culture podcast bugle. I'm Andrew Harrison.
And I'm Sian Pattenden.
On this week's show, Watteau Giotto, Queen Beyoncé of the Cardinals, is back with her new album Renaissance. What will we think of her return to the DISCO?
And Andrew's in hog heaven as we watch 80-centric sci-fi mystery Paper Girls on Amazon Prime, based on the comic book series by Brian K. Vaughan and Cliff Chang. When four girls meet up on their morning paper round, the past, present and future collide. Is it strong enough to rival Stranger Things? Plus, we dip into the slippery world of 1980s Aussie broadcast news with The Newsreader, hence the name, a series now showing on the BBC.
All this and more on today's Culture Bunker. Welcome aboard, everyone, and welcome to today's guest. Michael Hogan is a writer and chief Magic Lantern critic at The Telegraph, plus he's a keen dog owner. How are you, Michael?
I'm good. I thought you were going to say I was a keen dogger. No, that too.
But we're saving that for
the late night podcast.
Late night unplugged edition. You watch television for a living, which increasingly feels like what I do as well. For those holidaying at home this year and not stuck in Kent on a massive tailback, enjoying the unrivaled scenery of lorries and vans and so forth, what should we be watching right now?
Well, nothing that's on actual TV, because it's the dead month of TV, July and early August. So nothing good's happening at the moment. So I think you should be delving into your streaming services and your back catalogue of things you haven't bothered watching on your recorder.
What kind of gems are on iPlayer and Netflix and things that we haven't?
I tell you what arrives on iPlayer on Monday that hasn't been on iPlayer bafflingly for about 10 years is Clocking Off, the Paul Abbott factory-based anthology series, which is very good indeed. So I would recommend that.
We managed to miss somehow Sherwood on this podcast, which everybody went bonkers for. Tell us what Sherwood did that set it apart.
Well, it was a very personal project for writer James Graham. He grew up in a sort of a former mining village in Nottinghamshire. And he kind of connected his personal story with true crime, with these two murders that happened, with the miners' strike, with the politics of today in this really clever way. He's a playwright by trade, and you could kind of tell. We also had this incredible ensemble cast of, like, you know, Leslie Manville and Adiel Akter and David Morrissey were all at the top of their game. And, yeah, one of the best things of the year, I think.
I think my neck and neck for that one is The Responder.
Yes.
Which I obviously
right up there.
Scout bias. But I just thought it was so cleverly written and hit the spot so well for finding a part of the police life that has not really been explored. The fact that it would drive you to the absolute brink and, you know, what you can do with sort of showing the interior life of someone, showing them how that they would, you know, they would be almost forced to break the law by the situation that they're in.
Yeah, it's like a sort of dramatised version of a sort of late night documentary series, isn't it?
And
it's very visceral, I think, in that way. And Martin Freeman does quite a good impression of Stephen Graham for six episodes.
He does. Well, my mum said couldn't fault the accent. Couldn't fault that. That was her main.
Unlike Sherwood, where lots of people faulted the accent, I'm afraid.
Or even Peaky Blinders, where it seems that old Birmingham was a melting pot of the world.
Yeah, but Peaky Blinders was last episode of Peaky Blinders was one of the greatest hours of TV.
It was a Peaky Blinder.
It was.
Yeah.
Have you seen The Final Neighbours yet?
I have.
Oh, have you?
We are going out on the Saturday morning now, so no spoiler. You can spoil to your heart's content. Tell us.
It's so naff. It's glorious. It's like a sort of, it's less of a sort of hour of drama and more of a kind of clip show. they manage to weave all the old characters and loads of callbacks and stuff into the drama by all these kind of slightly cheesy devices, like plain Jane Superbrain, Jane Harris, is reunited with Mike, played by Guy Pearce. And she gives him a sort of tour of Ramsey Street, which is like going under the hammer. So all the houses are being sold. So everyone's getting very nostalgic. So she gives him a tour of Ramsey Street around the old houses. And he kind of goes, oh, this is the room where such happened. And then there's a clip of it and stuff. And meanwhile, Susan Kennedy's compiling this scrapbook of Ramsey Street memories, because Ramsey Street's about to be auctioned off and demolished, I think. So there's all these kind of clever ways of getting all the nostalgia in, and loads of old characters come back. And yeah, I won't spoil it completely for anyone who's yet to watch it live, but it's well worth it. You don't need to have watched Neighbours for the last 20 years, which is quite handy because no one has.
sounds exactly like the way Brookside ended.
They even do a little medley at one point of all the various iterations of the theme tune, kind of mixed together like sort of like Soul wow. Wax have sort of knocked it out in their lunch hour.
Fantastic. Before we move on, a reminder, you can get the Culture Bunker and all our shows early and without ads when you support the Bunker on Patreon. That means daily episodes on politics, science, pop culture and much, much more. You'll be supporting truly independent broadcasting and helping us find new stories and feature new voices. So just search Patreon Bunker Podcast to find out more.
Well, it is the dead summer, so let's start with something surprising. A massive release in music at the end of July when the entire music business is on the beach and so are all the punters. Renaissance is Beyoncé Knowles' seventh album, her first proper solo record since 2016, and apparently it's act one of a three-part art project. Built as a dance record, its legions of producers include house DJ Honey Dijon and Skrillex. Grace Jones makes a guest appearance. The cover features a nude Beyoncé on a crystal horse, because why not? What will we make of it? And is a new Beyoncé release just a pop record, or is it a socio-political event? Now, unsurprisingly, we can't clear a track because, you know, you have to join a long line of supplicants in the court of Queen Beyoncé. But we're going to put the single Break My Soul on the playlist. Michael Hogan, what are your initial reactions to Beyoncé Part 7? What did you think?
I thought it was really, really great, actually. I think you're right. Beyoncé records do tend to get freighted with this kind of socio-political event status. But I think she's deliberately shrugged that off, and it's just a really great pop record. It's like, it's full of disco and house. It's even got a name. Renaissance sounds like a sort of dodgy rave from the...
Well, actually, Renaissance 80s. Was a great
was.
Rave.
Was
yeah.
It?
Yeah, it was one of the best raves,
And it's, yeah, so it sounds like that, or a kind of club compilation.
Do you think the fall will be called Telepathy, Biology, 108K Turbo yeah. Sound System?
Part three will be yeah. Ibiza Sunset. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. I mean, I've only listened to it the once because it came out this morning, but my entire family were sort of bouncing along to it. It's just, yeah. It's really upbeat and sort of hedonistic, and it's got a kind of feeling of post-pandemic euphoria, I think, about it, which she's captured really well. Unpolitical and all party.
Yeah, I mean, it's all grooves and they're not particularly heavy on the songs, is it? I mean, there is a huge amount of house here. That track, Break My Soul, which you just mentioned, it was astonishing things written about it over the summer about how, have you heard about this house music thing that Beyoncé has discovered? And say every house DJ on earth was not happy with this at all. Mm. But the closing track, Summer Renaissance, it actually features her doing I Feel Love. And she thinks, I want to house you, I want to spouse you.
Yeah, there's like a Robin-esque. Yeah. Sample isn't there, and you know, obviously Grace Jones is on there. I think Nile Rodgers pops up, or certainly it sounds like he does.
Cuff It, he's on.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of an 80s and 90s club music, but sort of reinvented for a kind of hot girl summer.
There's quite a lot of affirmation pop here, isn't there? She's singing, I'm comfortable in my skin, I'm cozy with who I am on Cozy. It should cost $1 billion to look this good on Pure Honey. Is affirmation pop's job now the kind of thing that people will say to themselves in the mirror in the morning to put their armour on for the day?
I think partly, yeah. I mean, I saw a tweet just now, actually, on the journey in here by Ash Sarkar, you know, the left-wing political commentator, saying that she doesn't think there's any artist whose records make her feel as good as Beyoncé's records. Just because they're not only are they musically exciting, but the lyrics are so affirmative and so kind of powerful, and kind of, it's basically you go girl.
About to say this. You go girl. It's looking at yourself in the mirror. You've read your book on assertiveness, and how no one should tread you down at work or something. And you say you go girl. You listen to Beyoncé, and then you're out the door.
You do you girl.
Yeah, it's Oprah Winfrey's all night piano bangers, isn't it? Yeah,
which I'll tell you what, though, it's really rude though. This record,
it's pretty filthy,
isn't it?
There's loads of swearing on it. My little girl who's 11,
I mean the opener. If you think the opener,
quite shocked by
the sample where. Please, motherfucker. Please, motherfucker.
Yeah.
He just,
There's a lot of MF, and I think there's even a C bomb a couple of times.
Crikey,
That one. Yes, yeah. Crikey. She says twice.
But towards the end of the, am I allowed to say it? Am I allowed to quote the lyric?
Give it a go.
There's that one at the end that's got. I felt a lot of it was very gay, obviously, and very influenced by the kind of voguing ballroom
drag ball. Yeah,
and there's that one at the end which is Pure Honey, I think, where it says money, money, hunty.
Crikey.
Is the refrain.
Well, there's a track on it as well called America Has a Problem, and I was like kind of stealing myself. I'm like,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's Childish Gambino. This is what's going to happen.
It's just about shagging. It's just about loads of shagging.
America Has a Problem, and that problem seems to be sex.
Yes,
or not enough of it.
Sean, what did you think?
Absolutely adored it. As I say, we all listen to this on a Friday morning because that's when we get our hands on it. This is the record that Lizzo meant to make.
Right.
And where Lizzo's fell flat, sorry Lizzo, she's a goddess, but she meant to do this. This is very much You Go Girl in the Mirror, but somehow Beyonce has just, I'm going to use that, I can't think of saying anything, but she's smashed it. I know I'm a moron for saying that, but when you think, you know, she's got an enormous tick box. It needs to have a groove. It needs to be really edgy. I need to get the best producers on here. The lyrics have to be really exciting, but they can't alienate. She's ticked every single box. You just go, yes.
Well, also, it has to be true to her persona as well, doesn't it? Because she's built this kind of sort of...
She can't go too either way.
Yeah, this sort of indestructible sort of pop dreadnoughts.
And that must be very difficult to work with because, you know, songs about vulnerability and fragility, well, they're not Beyonce. You know, and when she wants to sing something like that, she's just got to hive it in, you know, clip it in with this stuff. But it's amazing. The lyrics are amazing. I was writing them down very quickly. I have written down super gay as well. Pure Honey. Yeah. It's just incredible. There's church girls acting loose.
Yes.
So when you have a song about church girls, it's not about them going to church.
It's not about them going to church, is it?
It's not. There's lots of things about sofas.
You can
there's
be my daddy if you want to.
There's a track about got to take plastic off the sofa.
Which is a brilliant lyric, isn't it?
I was not aware of the thing of keeping the plastic on your sofa, which is a big deal in America. It's like when you keep the sofa nice. Yeah. You're a multi-billionaire beyond the sofa.
It's a big deal in kind of certain pockets of working class culture here too, keeping your plastic on your sofa.
I don't remember that.
Yeah, man.
Nah.
Same thing of those people who put a bit of plastic sheeting over the new carpet. Do you know what I mean? Sort of
well, she's taken the plastic off that sofa.
She certainly has.
With pure sex, she's removed it.
Oh, my God.
She's sexed off the plastic.
But it is wonderful. And so let's be pretentious for a moment. This is Erica Jong, isn't it? Erica Jong? Sorry, I said that again. This is Erica Jong, this album. It's Zipless Funk. It totally is. It's about absolute abandon. And that's what's so glorious about it. Is it does have edges and it's quite, you know, in your face. You know, it's not pulling any punches.
Taste me, the fleshy part. Right? I scream so loud.
Yeah, and lots of I like it rough and I like it this. You just think, you go, girl. It's all cliches around my room.
The post-Black Lives Matter Beyoncé was a very different proposition to Crazy in Love Beyoncé, and it feels like she's kind of gone back to Crazy in Love Beyoncé a little bit.
Yeah.
And she's riding the silver horse from the Anglia TV idents.
this is true.
Which appeals to the East Anglian in me.
Do you think Studio 4 nicked off Anglian TV?
I think they borrowed it. It's been gathering dust backstage at Nicholas Parsons' house.
Did we notice that the hook on Alien Superstar, I'm Too Classy for This World, is a Right Said Fred still, and they get credit.
Yeah,
they get so publishing. They're getting
money. Isn't that annoying? The anti-vax.
All the, Beyonce's novice funding. Think about it,
That's a
5G masks, guys.
And I disagree. I think there are loads of bangers on it. The more you listen to it, which is 2.5 in my case, there are loads of tunes and Renaissance, obviously. Well, at the
there's
end.
Loads of bangers and there's loads of grooves. Not so much verse chorus. I don't care about verse chorus myself. I'd rather have the banger.
It's a dance album. You know, the tracks are even kind of mixed together, aren't they? And into a sort of a kind of club mega mix.
And someone else said, I think it was on the Twitter that it. You can listen to it as if it was an essentials mix or something like that. Mm. Everything is, you know, seamlessly sequenced. Yeah. Nothing stands out. It all flows into one another. That's an art in itself.
Also, there are certain bits of it that it's like a sound bed to Love Island, isn't it? You know what I mean? It's so sort of summery and sexy and kind of burbles away.
Now, should we worry when artists announce multi-part art projects that there'll be an act two and act three? Are we heading to pretentious city?
But there's nothing wrong with being pretentious. I just hope that act two and three are something being completely off the wall, like one's a restaurant and the other one's a kind of ballet. You know?
Sean, it does appear that Beyoncé is, to an extent, criticism-proof. I mean, as if she sort of has this burden of representing all of Black America.
Yes.
And if you question what she does, her fans get exceptionally vociferous. I got the sense that this is almost her breaking out of that a bit as well. And I want to enjoy myself.
She has said, in quotes around this, that she wanted to make mistakes. She wanted it to be flawed. She wanted it just to be really spontaneous. Mm. And I wrote in my notes, to criticise this is like criticising a tree or a field. You can't criticise it. It becomes, you know, she's so meta. She is beyond Beyonce in that way. Mm. She's just this incredible force of nature. It sounds absolutely perfect, even though it's flawed. I just think... anyone who did criticise this would have a very, very mealy mouth.
She's releasing the wiggle, that statement said, as well, didn't she?
Yes, and the wiggle.
The record very much is released.
Yes, the wiggle is going mad.
It's spraying around the room now like a deflating balloon.
Yeah. Well, I think we can all agree. Well done, Beyonce.
Yeah.
Like she needs it from us, but yes. Well done, Beyonce. Every week we ask our guests to bring in a current favourite track of theirs. As an enormous service to you, the listener, it takes them ages. Michael Hogan, what have you brought in and why do you love it?
I've brought in Sonny the Strong by Gaz Coombs, the Supergrass frontman. I don't think his solo career gets quite the credit it deserves. I've liked lots of the stuff he's released. And this is a lovely tale. It's about a post-war British boxer. And it starts off quite low-key and Americana and sort of builds into something quite emotive and novelistic. And well done, Gaz, like well done, Beyonce.
Great. And we've cleared it so we can hear a little bit of it. And it's also going on the playlist. Gaz Coombs and Sonny the Strong. Ooh, it's hard to find when your love lies bleeding.
When Stranger Things took off in 2016, I insisted to anybody who would listen that they had to read Paper Girls, a comic book series by writer Brian K. Vaughan, who was already a star for his family space opera series Saga, and the artist Cliff Chang, whose take on Wonder Woman is absolutely amazing and beautiful. The coincidence of the two series running at the same time was uncanny. They shared a kind of conflicted nostalgia for their 80s Reagan-era setting. They shared an atmosphere of a low-budget creepshow horror movie. And most importantly, it was all about the kind of Goonies, Stand By Me theme of teenage friendship being formed and broken under pressure. But Paper Girls was very different, with a cast of female teens and a time travel theme that asks questions of how these young lives might play out. Half a decade later, Paper Girls finally makes it to TV in its own right on Amazon Prime Video. What are we going to think? And will the story that was Stranger Things before Stranger Things was Stranger Things make it out from the shadow of Stranger Things? Here's a trailer for some vibes.
Hey! What's your name?
Aaron.
Tiff. So you're Mac, right?
So?
So you're the first paper boy around here. Who was it?
A boy. You must be the Brandman kid.
KJ.
My dad says you people own everything.
You people?
She's new.
All right, Big Mac. Let's go.
I'm not gonna, like, bite you or something.
Why does the sky look like that?
Move, move, move! Let's get out of here!
Hey! Who's there? What are you doing in my house?
What are you doing in my house?
I live here.
No, I live here.
That's her. Holy shit.
This is a psychotic break.
12-year-old version of yourself broke into your house with her punk friends?
If that really is future you, maybe she can call someone.
Who's she gonna call?
Time travel 911?
Do you want to call 911?
Oh, good lord, there are future robots.
Okay, the setup is we're in Stony Stream, a suburb of Cleveland, Ohio, and a racially mixed group of girls, also a class mixed group of girls, are doing their paper round when they are robbed by a gang of older boys, and in their attempt to get their stuff back, they stumble into a time machine and a huge temporal conflict. We've all been there. Sean, I mean, these girls aren't friends to start out with, but they're kind of pushed into one's company and they have to deal with one another. What did you think of it? What were your reactions?
Well, it's a classic scenario that can be done really badly. And all disparate people are suddenly pushed together and they're going to have a little bit of a fight, but in the end you'll realise that through temporal conflict, they all get on. I really, really enjoyed this. Mm. I thought it was beautifully paced. I thought it was beautifully done. It outstrangered Stranger Things, which I stopped watching after about season one. I mean, one of the first tracks as well, they know their stuff. One of the first tracks is a really early New Order song.
Mm. Age of Consent.
You know, it's not Fine Time. It's not something, you know, and you just think, they know their stuff. This is good. And it really sets it. And the music...
It's not often you hear Debbie Gibson.
Yes, I
heard
Debbie Gibson as well. It's really brilliantly done. I really like the characters. I thought it was just, I say it's just hard sometimes not to make them papery, get it thin.
Yeah.
There's something about the direction in that you really do feel there are these inner lives of these teens. Mm. And that's really hard to do. And I was very drawn in. I've only done 1.5, but I thought it was fantastic. It really, yeah, something about it that seemed authentic, man, that this was, you know, coming from a really good place.
I'm delighted that you liked it, because obviously I'm kind of invested in it. Yeah. It was a load of rubbish, Andrew. You have terrible taste. I mean, our way in is the Chinese-American kid, Erin, whose mum doesn't speak English. She has to take responsibility for the family. She's under constant pressure. There's the working class girl, Mac, with an alcoholic mother, and she's always got a fag on the go, and she's extremely aggressive.
She's basically Edward Furlong from Terminator 2.
Same hair, same vibe, same energy. Yeah. We've got African-American kid, Tiffany, who you will learn later on has got bigger future than you can possibly imagine. Mm. And KJ, who's from a wealthy Jewish family, and Mac is always, basically, Mac has come from a background of, you know, more or less conspiracy theory anti-Semitism, and is always having a go at it. You guys own the world. Mm. No spoilers, but that story's going to play out in a very interesting way. As the female in the room, Sean, who's spent her time in female only, is this what girls are like at the age of 12? That kind of on top of each other case getting?
Yeah, absolutely. It felt really like, as I say, it's hard to show in episode 1 of something that there are inner lives, backstory. Mm. Obviously, we're dealing with the future and the future of what they're going to be like without it sort of just seeming like a mess or forced upon these people. Mm. But there's something really cohesive about it and really lovely. And the reference points aren't too sort of stuck on. You know, we know they're in the 80s. We know there are some things they can do and some things they can't. Technology. I like the fact they're all on bicycles, so it's like E.T. as well.
Yes.
You know, those things are just really lovely, and they're placed there rather than pushed in your face. As I say, I just think it's really beautiful. The tone is really, really good. It's beautifully paced in that way.
And the plot motor is time travel, as we say. The girls encounter, they're trying to basically get their stolen walkie-talkie back. It's like classic sort of schoolyard fighting. Stuff. And they encounter these two kind of weirdly modified teenagers who are not speaking an identifiable language. And what we discover is their time machine, which pings them back and forth on timeline. But what it really is about is the girls encountering their future selves and what each party thinks of the other. Mm. So the first one we encounter is older Erin.
Yes.
So who's gone from a
I've only got to that point, you see.
Well, without too many spoilers, a 12-year-old girl of great promise and great ambition, and the older version of herself that she meets is very, very different.
Yeah, she's quite disappointed with herself, isn't she?
Yeah.
With how life has turned out for herself. Yeah. Whereas another one, you know, I think it's one of them sort of Googles herself and is very excited by what she finds in the future.
Yeah.
I think it's really, it's really clever and poignant about aging and the disappointments of life. Like they all seem so full of energy and promise, don't they, when they're 12. I thought they were older than 12, by the way. They felt like they're more
they
like
14
to me.
They are sort of,
But anyway.
In the comic, they're 12. But I mean, what did you think about Michael overall?
I loved it, yeah. I thought it was really good. I sort of didn't want to love it because it was so you. It was annoying.
Yeah.
But it turned out, you know what you're talking about. Yeah, it was really good. I think, you know, there are flaws in it. The whole sort of future war thing that they kind of end up in is a bit hokey, I think. You know, sort of Blake 7 costumes and
the problem with that is what?
You know, you can tell it's the budget of Stranger Things is not the same with Paper Girls, let's say. But although the sky goes pink, as it does in Stranger Things, I thought they were going to be the upside down. No, it's really good. The dynamic between the four girls is just brilliant. And you know, they reference things like Buffy and the Babysitter's Club and stuff. They know the reference points. The soundtrack's brilliant.
Yeah.
And that, I don't know if you watch Yellow Jackets, that brilliant.
No,
American
I never saw
series.
That.
But a lot of that is, that's kind of dual timeline stuff about a group of schoolgirls and then the other half is set with their grown-up selves.
Mm.
And it's very much like that. It's kind of Yellow Jackets meets Doctor Who.
Yeah.
And, you know, what's not to love about that?
Mac, in particular, we get a glimpse of the kind of damaged background that she comes from. She's, like, trying to retrieve a packet of cigarettes out from underneath her mother, who may be drunk or may be drugged out. They're properly dirt poor. And I really like the way that the kind of class dynamic plays out, because that's something that doesn't really get talked about that much in American fiction.
Yeah, they're not as obsessed with class as we are. But, yeah, the sort of the spiky relationship between the kind of the rich Jewish princess and the kind of the trailer park girl is nicely done and not too clumsy. Mm. She is like Edward Furlong, though. I just couldn't get that out of my head the whole time. She's got that kind of same hair. She calls people, you know, dick wad and ass clown and things like he does. And she's constantly flipping the bird at people's backs as they walk off. And it's brilliant. But, you know, all the girls that have a really, as Sean said, they're all, you know, within the first, I've seen the first two episodes, which add up to like 70 minutes. And within that time, they arrive as fully formed characters, yeah, I think. Yeah. It's the writing is really clever.
Do you feel it's faithful to the comic?
It's really, really faithful. And in a good way. Because sometimes things are often faithful to the comic in a way that even I am saying, why are you doing this? The comic is not always perfect. I mean, occasionally decisions are made in comics that are just driven by deadline. The large parts of the Marvel Cinematic Universe are investing billions of dollars in something that was made up in a panicky afternoon by Stan Lee or Jack Kirby to fill a page.
Yeah.
And then suddenly there it is on the screen. Mm. I love this. Many of the scenes directly mirror the comics. Cliff Chiang is an incredible artist. He's unlike any other comic artist. It's very simple, clear lines, incredibly expressive. None of this kind of bulging biceps and he even drew Wonder Woman without the bulging biceps.
Did she have a sword with a snake wrapped around it, though? That's what I want to know.
I don't know. She had the Lasso of Truth, which is okay. Very important.
It's
got a bit important to the middle.
Harrison is in his 50s.
Mid to late 50s. But, I think it's really faithful in the best way, which is it's faithful to the characters. Brian K. Vaughan puts a lot of women in his comics, and I think he does it because he wants to try and intellectually explore women on the page to work out his ideas. Much as I enjoyed Stranger Things, it's quite saccharine and it's quite boysy. And it's quite a lot about the kind of the fascination and fear of the only girl in the whole story.
Admittedly,
she is a telekinetic super person, so you would be quite frightened of her. But the most frightening thing about her is she's a girl.
In Stranger Things' defense, I think, you ducked out of series one, I think, and series two and three are disappointing. Series four, massive return to form, partly because they foreground another female character.
And often when things include a female friendship, they're not about female friendship, and this is about the girls getting on, and you actually start to invest in, are they getting on, why don't they, and something about their dynamic is so strong.
It's a Bechdel test home run in every scene, isn't it?
I thought you could sort of tell that it was from a comic book because it was so full of ideas. It was like a sort of, occasionally there'd be like a panel would arrive, like a different scene would be something completely different. But in a really exciting way, I thought. It was like, oh, this is happening, and they're being mugged, and then suddenly next frame, ow, time war, and then next frame, ow, I've been shot. Do you know what I mean? There was so much thrown at it, but I thought it was really exciting.
Well, Brian K. Vaughan is the absolute cliffhanger merchant. I mean, this is one of the reasons I find his comic so addictive, in that you know you're going to get to page 25 and there will be something that makes your jaw drop. There's one really annoying thing about this, which is because it comes from Amazon, it can't have the jaw-dropping scene at the end of issue one, which is in 1988, at a time when, we're running around on bikes and there's no internet and anything else, a certain object has the Apple logo on the back of it, which cannot possibly have an Apple logo on it. And that's the thing that opens up the whole story and makes you go, what the hell is going on here? And they can't do that because it's Amazon. They can't put the Apple logo on it.
They do. They have quite a clever scene with an Amazon Alexa.
They do, which is a very, very good. There's some of the best parts of it are just the girls wandering around in their own future and just amazed, just standing in front of an animated billboard in awe, unable to believe that the future has panned out the way it has in some ways.
And they ask for a phone book and they go, no, we've got the internet now. And they're like, wow.
They don't even have phone books.
It's like a phone book on a computer.
It's just really endearing and extremely faithful. I'm really encouraged, not just that you guys liked it, but also I did a little bit of, checked out the reviews this morning. And everybody is saying, this is not just Stranger Things. This is its own thing with its own dynamic. It actually has its own pace as well. I liked the best of Stranger Things, but it was very overloaded with music and very overloaded with the reference. This has a kind of a more open pace, and there's more time for the girls to interact and for you to discover why they are.
It feels like more nuanced than Stranger Things, I think. It's more subtle, and it's got a pet hamster called Weird Al.
Wait till later in the series where the giant pterodactyl start to appear. That's all I'm saying. When you said it's out Stranger Things, I think I might email that to the marketing department and see if they fancy putting that on a poster somewhere.
Sure.
I'm delighted that you liked it because I have, like I say, personal investments in this one. Go on, Paper Girls.
Hey. Now it's the turn of Mr. Andrew Harrison to bring in a tune for you, the listener. What have you brought in, Andrew Harrison?
Well, long-time listeners will remember that we reviewed the album Telefish, which was a collaboration between Cathal Coughlan of Micro Disney and the Fatima Mansions and the producer Jack Knife Lee, and it was brilliant. It was a concept album about Irish state television in the 60s. I think he called it something like, if you're only going to buy one theocratic electronic album about the Irish diaspora, this is the one to buy. Yeah. Well, amazingly, there's another one coming out later this year. Very, very sadly, Cathal, who was he was a listener to this podcast, and he actually supported us on Patreon with his own
and
money.
And he sent us his CDs when they came.
Yeah, he passed away a couple of months ago, which was a big shock to a lot of people, because I sort of imagined that there was going to be a David Bowie-esque late career flowering for this brilliant, brilliant
and
guy.
And he'd been planning loads of stuff.
Yeah, but there is more Telefish music, and there's a single from the next Telefish album. It's called Space Is Us. And it's a collaboration between Cathal, Jack Knife Lee, and Sean O'Hagan of Micro Disney. Mm. So there's a bit of kind of coming together here. And it's a great tune. It is funny and strange, like the best of Cathal Coughlan always was. And here's a little bit of it now. Space Is Us by Telefish. Feet. Dot. Sean O'Hagan. Let the shackles go.
Finally, Lady Reads the News. The Newsreader is a six-part series starring Anna Torv as Helen, a put-upon broadcaster, all set in 1986. Thatcher, AIDS, Halley's Comet, we see them here as if they are current news stories. It was Australian TV channel ABC's most watched drama programme of 2021. But what will us Poms think of it? Here's the trailer to give us a bit of a flavour.
We are back in four.
Newsreading, not for everyone.
60 Minutes are sending female reporters to war zone.
You're a war zone on two legs.
She contracted HIV through a blood transfusion.
Used to have a serious news audience.
And we started serving them glamour.
He told me it was all rumours.
Can I get that interview?
Let's do it.
I plan to put up a fight.
Yes!
Don't you do it, huh? Not now, screen. Camera goes on her. Magic.
I always come good when it counts.
You're incredible.
Michael Hogan, I'm going to start with you because you're good at the telly. Set this up for us. What is happening here?
Well, it's about the relationship between the female anchor, co-anchor, Helen Norville, played by brilliant Anna Torv, who's great in Fringe. I don't know if you've watched that. That's probably up your rue, Andrew. J.J. Abrams' underrated series around the time of Lost. And she was also great in Mindhunter. And she's a dead ringer for like a young Cate Blanchett in this. In fact, I thought it was Cate Blanchett for about the first 10 minutes. And she is kind of battling the patriarchy to have her talent recognised. There's like a sort of a git of a boss and a slightly entitled co-anchor. She's great. Her sort of her pussy bow blouse and her shoulder pads quiver with frustration at various points that she has not having her talent recognised. But also she's quite she's much more nuanced than you think she's going to be. So you think the first 10 minutes you think she's going to be a sort of dynasty style super bitch because it's set in that kind of era. But beneath the hairspray and the power frocks, it's just the armour she wears, I think. It's her war paint. And it turns out she's quite complex off screen and she's maybe has a prescription pill habit and maybe some mental health problems. And as one of the male colleagues says, she's a nightmare off screen, but she's magic on it. So it's about sort of difficult women in the workplace. And she forms a really nice sort of friendship stroke possible romance with an ambitious young male reporter called Dale Jennings, who's played by Sam Reed, who was very good. I don't know if you ever saw an Australian drama called Lambs of God. It's kind of folk horror about four nuns on a deserted island who've invented their own religion, essentially.
Great.
Anyway, like Dark Father Ted.
Yes, so Father Ted meets the Wicker Man. anyway, Sam Reed turns up in that as like the priest who discovers this kind of strange thing. Anyway, he's very good as well, and it's about their relationship and how they try and sort of reshape the news program they work on. It's very nostalgic. The first episode covers the space shuttle disaster. Mm-hmm. The second one covers Halley's Comet. The AIDS crisis is mentioned. Chernobyl comes later in the series.
Cabbage Patch Kids.
Cabbage Patch Kids are mentioned. Yeah, there's even, you know, the baby being snatched by a dingo. You know, that's the thing that Meryl Streep made a film about. The first episode also starts with Paul Hogan, no relation, being named Australian of the Year, which locates it so specifically in a time. And it's really evocative. It's kind of, you know, it's Mad Men meets the Morning Show. I think it's really nicely done. It's very brown and beige, isn't it? The offices are so horribly 80s.
Everybody's smoking all the time.
Yeah, everyone's smoking all the time. Everyone's got a really dodgy duvet cover.
Yeah. And all the blokes are always asking the women to do annoying menial tasks.
Yes, so, yes.
You're not going upstairs to the coffee shop? Yeah. No, I'm not. Yeah. Well, you know.
Yes, yeah, so going to the photocopier.
For and one of them, wears a kind of a pink tie at one point because he's watching Miami Vice and everyone takes the mickey out of him.
Yeah.
What are you wearing a pink tie for, mate?
So it's been saying that it's familiar territory at the start. It's a woman in a man's world, basically. Andrew, what did you make of it?
I thought it was fantastic because I liked the fact that it managed to take a very modern perspective on that. It's nostalgia, but it's not cheap nostalgia. It's not, hey, who remembers Dilly Boppers? It's like, who remembers this? Who remembers when work was like this? And it was awful. She is under enormous pressure and clearly someone who, in our current context, would be regarded as seriously vulnerable, seriously in need of self-care. Mm-hmm. And yet her working environment is not just sexism, but Australian sexism, which is bigger and more muscly than ordinary sexism and you know, a lot more relentless. And yet within that, we also get, you know, this certain characters may not be sort of who you think they are in their sexual orientation. Mm-hmm. They may not be who you think they are in terms of their career ambitions. Mm-hmm. There's certainly a whole lot of stale, pale and male dudes who are kind of blocking the doorway to the bright young people. Yes. But that is not approached in any form of a cliched manner. Everybody has their flaws. Everybody's fighting their own battle, even the sort of nominal villains. So in certain respects, it's like Network. Yeah. I mean, and it quotes and nods to Network
it
very heavily in the very,
very
first scene.
Very much so,
also
yes.
Nods very directly towards Flashdance. A lot of hair tossing going on here. But it's clever and inquisitive enough about its own material to dig into that and to look at the psychologies of each and every person on the screen. I loved it. I absolutely devoured it. And I'm kind of disappointed it's only a 6-episode thing and appears to be a limited series with a definitive ending.
I think it's a shame. But obviously, it's quiet time for TV at the moment, so BBC Two have kind of plugged a gap with it on Sunday nights. Mm. They're airing it in double bills. Mm. And they're kind of slightly throwing it away, I think. I think it's better than that.
It's the kind of thing that 20 years ago would be going out on BBC One at 10 o'clock as a major flagship drama, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I'm hoping that it's got pretty good reviews. I'm hoping people will discover it. But, you know, a BBC Two Sunday night drama tends to not be watched by many people, sadly.
Yeah.
But it's won loads of awards in Australia. And as Sean says, it's, you know, the big ratings hit of last year.
I've seen a lot of people mentioning it on social media. Going, good. I just stumbled upon this thing and it's fantastic. You should give it a go. And there is a whole lot of Blanchett energy coming off Anna Torv, isn't there?
Oh, you'd be happy, wouldn't you?
Yeah, Andy. Yes. Very marvellous. Yes, oh, yes. Great actor. but I also enjoy the fact...
Work.
Steady on. But I also enjoy the fact... You know, I love watching things where I don't know anybody at all the faces are new. This is why I enjoyed Mr. In Between so much. Mm. It's like I've never encountered any of these actors before and they're all brilliant. There seems to be a bit of a Australian drama renaissance going
there
on
is
at the
very
moment,
much, yeah.
With a subtle eye that many of our very, very broad brush domestic dramas don't seem to have.
Jack Irish is very good. Have you seen that?
No.
It's Guy Pearce detective drama.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
I think I have a Guy Pearce similar. I'm a very big fan of his work.
Yes.
With Andrew.
Talented, very, yes, very, yes. Very, very talented. Very,
so
very
there's
talented.
More to Australian TV than Neighbours, we're saying.
Well, there we go. So themes are emerging. And also, I mean, at the same time this series is taking place on the other side of the world, the girls from Paper Girls are rich. Chasing each other around with hockey sticks and dealing with time travel.
It's slightly depressing how our lives are now period dramas.
It is, yeah. What did you think about it, Sean?
Well, I really liked it, but I have reservations, man. I think the character of Helen seems to be contrasted with Dale Jennings, who is the up-and-coming. It sort of nicks her job at one point. Mm-hmm. He's incredibly bland. He's very, very bad at doing his job. Everybody laughs at him because he's just useless in front of camera. He's very stilted. But if I was Helen, I would be thinking, hang on a minute, what are you doing nicking my job? And there she is making him dinner.
But no,
she's thankful because of the, you know,
it does that didn't quite try and have its cake and eat it in terms of gender politics at times, I think.
Whereas I felt Helen actually should be Bolshevik and have a
She's
bit
a much more
edge.
Interesting character.
Yes,
than
absolutely. And I didn't want it to be about him so much that maybe it was.
I don't think he's an uninteresting character. Mm. There are complexities there. I think the answer to that is because he's the only person in that place that's been supportive towards her.
He's the nicest person in the place,
yeah,
isn't he?
Yeah, and he's the only person who seems to be. He also seems to be a new kind of news reporter, whereas the guys that she's dealing with most of the time are primarily, their goal in life is to be the big gruff male face on television telling it like it is.
Yes.
And he seems genuinely dedicated to news journalism and but also wants to be part of a team. He feels like a 90s guy in an 80s environment. And okay, we all know the problems with, hey, I'm just a nice guy trying to help out.
Yeah.
You know, but I think that's, you know, viewing everybody in context and at the time. They're a team, and it's a kind of a mismatched romance as well. It's a kind of a professional romance, and then maybe there's going to be some romance, but, you know, is Dale necessarily what she's looking for in a man? Without too many
spoilers. You're intrigued, yes. Yeah, I thought it might be played more as high camp. Did anyone else? When you see the first few scenes and you see the hairspray and the...
I'm glad it wasn't.
But it is camp enough in terms of the fact that it's Australian in the 80s, I think, adds a certain camp. Yeah. And Madge from Neighbours tips up in episode 2. Yeah, it's kind of soapy, but kind of classy as well.
Yeah, but it's like, what if soaps were done with real emotional intelligence and not broad strokes? And that's what I liked about it.
So we're recommending, we're saying, dig this out.
I'm giving it a go. I mean, I did not like The Morning Show.
The Morning Show didn't work for me either.
But lots of people think it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's definitely more on the other network end of things in the pressure and the kind of the way it distorts your personality and the way that that kind of conflicted desire to tell the truth and do journalism, but also I just want to be on the telly with my with my big shoulders stroke power.
It does. Yeah. I think for anyone who's ever worked in any kind of journalism, really, it brings home to you as well that brilliant sense of excitement when something terrible happens.
Yes.
Because it makes for good copy. And the people can barely conceal their glee when the Shea space shuttle explodes. And it's going to, you kind of lose your humanity there, don't you?
Yeah. And Helen is, you know, comes off having done a marathon, largely extemporized, done on the fly news report in a historic disaster, and gets a round of applause and is in ecstasy, is in raptures. Mm. And even the bad guy, even the horrible news is like, is that really the right thing to be doing? Should we really be making emotional entertainment out of this? And, you know, like all good dramas, the quotes baddies have a really strong point and the quotes goodies are flawed people because in the real world there are no goodies and baddies.
And that, yeah, the scene where Dale gets his big shot and messes up his first news bulletin as well is...
Yes.
You get clammy watching it.
His attempts at being an anchor just made me laugh.
They're kind of speeding up the autocue, then slowing it back down again. Doesn't he pretty much run out of copy and has to fill dead air at the end?
Exactly.
Like Alan Partridge when he's counting the clock down.
So I'm recommending.
Yeah. Cool.
Breaking news, Justin. It's really quite good.
Finally, regular listeners know we always ask our guests to bring in their favourite song of all time in the history of creation to add to our playlist. Michael Hogan, what have you chosen?
In tribute to our future overlord, Loony Liz, I've chosen Can't Trust It by Public Enemy.
Oh, see what you did there.
1991 slice of hip-hop fury, linking slavery to modern corporate America, and very prescient with the word trust in it.
Yes, I remember when it came out, a bit of British people found it distracting, shall we say.
Every time I see Liz Truss's name, I just find myself humming Can't Trust It to myself.
Well, we're exchanging a Johnson for a Truss. The tune, this one's going to go onto our rolling playlist, as are all the tunes we've mentioned today. And now it's on Tidal too.
Well, it's been updated.
Yay. It's finally updated.
And the new link will be in the show notes.
Yes.
And with that, we're at the end of the podcast and it's closing time chatter. What will we be discussing as we neck a bottle of Lambrini, put on our chainmail perv dress and head out to San Antonio for a night we won't forget?
Soundtrack by Beyonce, probably.
Exactly. Michael, what's your closing time chatter?
Well, I was quite excited this week by the news that, slightly predictably, but still thrillingly, Channel 4 are making a drama out of the Wagatha the Christie scandal.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
breaking
right.
news. Oh, Rebecca Vardy loses libel case against Rooney in Wagatha trial.
Hooray!
So
cool.
The scouse trap closes.
So, yeah, I mean, the whole thing has played out, is sort of stranger than fiction anyway. And crying out for that kind of treatment. So I'm glad that someone has presciently snapped at the rights and announced it in the same week that the verdict came in, very cannily. Mm. So it's Channel 4. It's going to be two-part miniseries. They're going to use sort of transcripts of the courtroom action to recreate those scenes mm-hmm. and flesh it out with kind of semi-fictionalized mm-hmm. scenes about the rest of the whole ridiculous saga. And we can now play fantasy casting as well.
Of course.
Stephen Graham as Wayne Rooney, I'm saying.
Oh, God, yes.
Please.
Go on, fantastic. Who else?
Jodie Comer. Jodie Comer as Colleen Rooney,
yeah,
I would suggest.
Yeah,
she can do the accent.
Yeah.
Mm?
Yeah.
Well, both of them can.
Vardy. The Vardys. Who are the Vardys?
Vardys are tricky, aren't they? Yeah. I mean, Rebecca could be Saran Jones. And mm-hmm. her and yeah. Jodie Comer have that Dr. Foster yeah. prickly rivalry already.
Yes. Yeah. Mr. Vardy?
Mr. Vardy.
Mackenzie Crook.
Yeah, possibly. You see someone a bit pointy-faced, don't yeah. you? Joe Gilgan from This Is England might be good. Yeah. Or I thought Jamie Bell might be good.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
A.K.A. Billy Elliot.
That'd be fantastic. Mm. Well, they've got some good material to work with. Mrs. Justice Stein has found that Rebecca Vardy's evidence in the trial was manifestly inconsistent with other evidence on many occasions. Basically, mm. she's a massive liar.
Really? You're saying that her phone didn't drop off the side of a North Sea ferry?
I'm saying that that may not be...
She didn't lose the password to her WhatsApp
entirely accurate. Right then.
Fabulous. I hope that they can make it in about a week or two and it'll be on in that boring bit in August.
But who's going to play Peter Andre's Chipolata?
Andrew, what's your closing time chatter?
Well, staying in the realm of thespians, I've got to say RIP to both Bernard Cribbins and David Warner. Bernard Cribbins, has there ever been a more beloved actor?
Yeah, absolutely.
93, good innings. Oh, what a way to go. Yay. Admired by everybody.
And hung on in there to film Doctor Who just before, about yeah, 2 weeks before, right. he died, which is brilliant. It's almost like he was waiting to do that. And then.
So he'll be appearing in, I mean, obviously the 60th anniversary Doctor Who will be out next year. I'll be watching through a flood of tears anyway. And then Cribbins will turn up and they'll have to get an ambulance for
then
him.
Then he'll just do that salute that he does to the
he
Doctor.
Will, yeah, stop oh, it. I'm going to go. Stop it. I'm going to be going in a minute. But also David Warner, the incredible David Warner, who himself has done a bit of Doctor Who, The Omen, Tron, everything. And just, my idea of what an actor is David Warner. So just two fantastic heroes, and we have to raise the hat for them.
Voice of the Wombles, Cribbins, of course.
Voice of the Wombles.
Voice of the Hobbit, just a Jack Anori, like so much sort of fiction was Cribbins. Voiced by Cribbins.
Cribbins was in the Doctor Who movies in the 60s as a young man, and then appears as Wilf at the end of his life. It's almost as if we're in a time travel scenario. Sean, what's yours?
As if it's the metaverse. It has to be Barack Obama's playlist 2022. Because obviously you start reading it and you read from the top to the bottom, Break My Soul, Beyonce, of course. Mm-hmm. Thames, Who They, Vibe Out. We've got a bit of Harry Styles. We've got Joe Cocker. All this stuff. Yeah, okay, I get it. Sampa the Great's in it. That's good. Al Green. At the bottom, Wet Leg.
Yay,
the leg are in there. Angelica. So interesting niche choice from Barack.
Not
there.
all day on the South Lawn.
You would have thought that maybe someone just goes, no, go
would,
on.
Would
do
he
do
like us to
tracks.
Assign someone to butter his muscle?
I think
as an ex-president, he's probably got a security detail to do that.
But isn't that wonderful? It was just so heartwarming. And obviously everybody has talked about how fantastic this is and what an amazing
I'm looking forward to Liz Truss's summer playlist.
Oh.
It's just going to be Elgar, isn't it?
Just when she couldn't get worse, she revealed today that she's a Norwich fan.
I'm not going to hold that against the Norwich City property.
She claims to be from Yorkshire, and she supports Norwich. What's that about?
That's an Adelia Smith thing, I don't know. You're an Ipswich Town fan, are you? Hate them?
I am,
there you go, that's why he hates her.
Can't trust it.
Well, can't trust it.
There you go. Well, what we're saying is just don't any UK politicians release your playlist.
Well, I mean, she likes... Top Loader, doesn't she?
Oh, of course
she
does.
Oh, yeah, Onka's
right.
Big Monk or whatever it was called.
Yeah.
Soundtracking Jamie Oliver sliding down a banister.
There you go.
In hell somewhere.
Absolutely. And with that beautiful image, that's the end of the podcast. Thank you so much to Michael Hogan for joining us in the Culture Bunker.
My pleasure.
Remember, you can get all the tunes on our rolling playlist. The link to Spotify and Tidal is at the top of the show notes. And if you subscribe to The Bunker, tomorrow you'll be getting episode 666 of The Bunker, our 666th episode. Exactly. And without giving too many things away, it's all about Satan himself and why he might not be what you think he is. So we'll see you on Sunday for that one. In the meantime, from me and Sean, from producers Alex Rees, Yelena Sofronievich and Jade Bailey, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Be here tomorrow for Satan himself.
Bye.
The The Culture Bunker was produced and presented by Andrew Harrison and Sean Pattenden. The producers were Yelena Sofronievich and me, Alex Rees. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker is a Podmasters production.